We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also very happy to have back on the program once again Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at the U of I. This is our monthly show on personal finance. Most of the time, Dave Sino is here, but we have a small rotating cast of characters that we'd like to see every once in a while. And occasionally, Kevin is here to do that. The same exercise. He maybe has a couple things that he'd like to talk about, but the idea here is that if you have a question that's specific about your own financial situation, you're planning for your retirement, to send children to college, maybe you're at the point where you're thinking about buying your first house. It doesn't matter where you are, if you're just starting or if your retirement is in sight and you have specific questions about your own decisions and you'd like to get a little bit of advice, you can call in and give us as much information as you can, and Kevin will do his best to help you out. He'll certainly tell you what he thinks. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to email, you can do that. Send it to will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's always good to be here.
So do you want to, I don't know, if one of the things that Dave does when he's here, he just talks a little bit about the couch potato portfolio. It'll be a little bit before we can update it on the web, but people can go to our website and they can see it. Anything real quick that you might want to say about how it's doing?
Nothing really, I would say, striking. I would only point out that one of the nicer things about the fact that portfolio is as split up or diversified as it is, I think is borne out in this particular reiteration of the rates of return. I believe the biggest draws or the biggest negatives in the year-to-date performance are pretty much in the international stock funds. Mm-hmm. And you might anticipate that be the case, given all of the news that we've heard over the past 6-8 weeks with problems throughout Europe, whether it's Greece or any other particular country. The nice thing about it is still in the year, roughly, that portfolio is still ahead just under 2%. And I believe as it would compare to an index of large U.S. stocks, it's roughly twice as good. So I think that's up just a little less than 1%. Sino does a great job pitching the fact that we shouldn't have all our eggs in one basket. And again, I just wanted to offer that as a kind of an opportunity to say there's good reason for that.
Sure. Well, you know, one thing, and I hope I'm reading this right, but I think actually, given what we've been through here the last couple of years, that sort of surprises me. The one thing on here that's done best year to date is the REIT. This essentially what this is it's a mutual fund that invests in real estate. And you would think, man, if there's one thing that's been in the tank, it's real estate. But actually, of all of this, that's the thing that's doing the best.
Well, and we've got to remember everything's relative. Some people say, most of my problems are my relatives, but that's another story. One of the things we've got to remember is real estate as an asset class was absolutely crushed. So as we went through the problems that we were seeing in the darkest days of 2008 and 2009, real estate investment trusts as an asset class were absolutely decimated. So to see that in a year-to-date performance or even in a rolling 12-month performance, that an asset class like REITs are up as strongly as they are, we have to remind ourselves that even compared to, say, the high in, let's say, early 2007, those assets are still worth much less than they were back at their peak.
Oh, so we're just talking about it having been really bad, and what we're seeing is performance that reflects a comeback from a really bad place.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a slight recovery in the economy. I think we're seeing a slight recovery in asset classes like this, but we have to remember that that was certainly an area that was hit the hardest when the economy itself was appearing to be close to falling off the cliff.
Yeah, it seems like for some time now when we've sat down and done this or when other people are looking at the economy, what they're looking for is any good signs, anything that they can grab onto that says, certainly it says the worst is over, but also that we're starting to climb back out of that hole. Well,
right.
What do you think?
And I think there is evidence to that progress. I also believe that, I mean, we're human, and I think by nature we're optimists. We should, and by nature we do, look for signs of good rather than signs of evil or signs of ugly. There's been so much bad news lately. I say lately, the past 3 years, whether it's economic news, the obvious problems that are now captivating our attention in the Gulf of Mexico with the oil spill, you know, those types of things really get to weigh a person down. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but I can see it in my colleagues' eyes when we talk about what's going on. We're literally getting beaten to a pulp with bad news. So again, basic human nature, I think we try to look for the silver lining. I think economically we're beginning to see some signs of more stability and certainly the potential for more growth. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that we're out of the woods, though. So I've got a little hypothesis that I'll lay on that score.
Mm-hmm. Questions, certainly we're talking about some big economic issues here, but the opportunity here is for you to ask specific kind of money management questions again. So you want to take the opportunity to do that. Kevin Waspy is the guest from the Department of Finance. He's a lecturer in finance at the College of Business here at the U of I. It's our monthly show on money management, something we always do on Friday. Once a month, 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And also you may send your emails to will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, generally speaking, what are you looking at these days?
Well, when I look out across the landscape, put it that way, if I were to believe that we're out of the woods economically, if this were the beginnings of a sustainable recovery and eventually things like high rates of unemployment were really going to come back to a more normal, then I would have to believe that interest rates would still not be as low as they are. And when I say interest rates, I'll just use as an indicator, yields on 1 month, 3 month, and 6 month treasury bills. This morning, 3 basis points for a 1 month treasury bill. That's 0.03%. A 3 month treasury bill at 9 basis points, and a 6 month treasury bill at 15 basis points. These are levels that are literally akin to the low levels that we saw very close to the time in late 2008 into 2009, when money was looking for a place that was literally the safe haven. These yields are as low now close to as low now as they were back then, which is a signal of money not wanting to take risk. In the same vein, if I see, an economic report that shows an improvement in some type of economic indicator series, whether it's a weekly jobs report, which unfortunately this week didn't give us any good signal, it gave us kind of a bad news signal, or a monthly employment report. The last month's report was at first heralded as the number of jobs created. Everybody picked the data apart. They found out that a vast majority of it was part-time hiring by the Census Bureau. The bottom line is the markets of risk and those telling indicators of whether or not people are willing to take investment risk just don't tell me that we're out of the woods yet.
Well, here, that this, I guess, gets to a question. Maybe this is always the question that people want to know: where can I put my money where I can make money, but that it's going to be safe? So, and I'm not exactly sure that return good high returns and safety ever go together. But So you want to make some, you got to make some trade-offs between those two things.
Sure. And that's an excellent point. In any environment, we ought to see that returns and risk are positively linked. We don't get rates of return without, how should we say, bearing risk. Think of a rate of return as a compensation. The harder you work, hopefully the harder you're, or the more you're compensated. Like your money doing the same. The harder your money works, meaning the more risky the endeavor is, the higher the rate of the return should be. We all try to look for a fair rate of return. I think that's the way to most appropriately phrase it. In the environment that we're in, we try to get a decent rate of return for the level of risk we're accepting. And at the moment, I just don't think the risk reward is in favor of making me feel very comfortable about a sustainable, long-term, we're out of the woods, everything's going to be fine type of economy. Mm. Just doesn't look that way.
So for then, it seems that there's still no other particularly great options if you want to make some money on your money, but you want to keep your risk down really low, and you also want to have access to that. It's sort of the standard things. Yeah, you know, there you go down to your bank, and there are a couple things that they can do for you, and that's pretty much going to be it.
Sure, and to you know, a theoretical end of things. I mean, what we're seeing right now is an extreme liquidity preference as savers, as investors. There is a strong preference to keep money liquid, keep it safe, however you want to phrase it. And obviously that contributes to the very low interest rates that I was just indicating. Now, that said, it doesn't mean that any one of us has to keep our money that we would deem safe money that safe. For instance, I've always been an advocate of, you know, setting up basically a pyramid structure for a person's financial house. So the building blocks, the foundation of that pyramid should be very safe money, literally things, savings accounts, certificates of deposit, and those kinds of things that you can build a more growth-oriented type of mix above. In doing that, if we've found that our pyramid now has a very huge base and very little above it, then it's an allocation issue. What's going on, what has gone on, the shock to the economy, the big capitulation in financial markets globally that's occurred over the past couple of years, I think has altered a lot of investor sentiment to the point of literally making that pyramid less high and more broad. More people are allocating more money into those safer foundation stones. That's not necessarily bad. As a matter of fact, I don't think it's even illogical if we look at a demographic kind of factual situation in our economy and the economies of most developed countries. People are aging. And generally speaking, as they age, they become more fiscally conservative, more inclined to have money as, how should we say, supplements to what might be a lesser income because of retirement or moving closer to retirement. Those kinds of things are just, I would say, characteristic with an aging economy to begin with. Add the insult of the huge market sell-off in 2008, 2009, and we've just accelerated that, perhaps overboard. We've, you know, gotten to a little bit of an extreme, but it's certainly reminded people who are moving closer to retirement that risk is a double-edged sword. Returns are fine when they come in positive numbers. They're really ugly when they come with a negative sign in front of them.
Yeah. Well, that's, I suppose that gets to the question of whether or not people, whatever it is that they're doing with their money, whether they are doing the adequate periodic reevaluation. So I think probably standard piece of advice is that really you should be doing that once a year, at least. And I suppose, though, some people get locked into, they do things certain ways, they put their money in certain places, and then maybe it seems to be okay, and year after year, they just sort of let that go. And certainly, where you are in your life should have some influence on where you've got your money. And I guess I wonder
exactly
whether in fact, people are, you know, how many people are really, some people, I'm sure, just like clockwork, they maybe it's at the end of the year. So maybe it's coming near the end of the year. You're kind of thinking about here's where we are. But I really wonder how many people do that.
That's an excellent point. That's sort of a venial sin for all the Catholics out there. Not taking advantage of a rebalancing opportunity, at least in some structured form, whether it's once a year or 18 months. I mean, we could talk about the numbers, the frequency. So the venial sin is to not take advantage of rebalancing opportunities. I think the mortal sin, and some people were captivated, were caught by this trap. They do just the opposite. So they look at their portfolio at the end of the year and they say, well, my goodness, those didn't do very well. So I'm going to get rid of those and I'm going to put that money into these things that really went well, which is the reverse of what they should be doing, obviously. If we believe that, you know, few things move in a straight line forever, the notion of rebalancing is to take profits in those asset classes that have performed well, reallocate them into asset classes that have done less well, and then maintain a balanced approach, again, back to the first topic that we discussed today, the kind of couch potato approach, the fact that diversification, having the split among different asset classes and different risk levels, is something that will probably serve a person quite well over the long term and even over the short term provide a benefit of being less volatile.
Well, there, though, that's so counterintuitive. I'm sure that there are people who would be listening and say, well, now, wait a minute, Kevin, you're really saying that what I should do is look at those things that did well and take some of that money and put it into the things that didn't do well. I'm sure that they would say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't.
It
make any sense.
It goes against, again, human nature. I believe we're optimists. You know, our creator kind of gave us an optimistic bias. So we look at something that did really well and say, wow, that's wonderful. I need to feed that some more. I need to put more there. Rather than saying something like, you know, nothing goes in a straight line forever. So it's really funny, but 2 months ago I was engaged in a really fun conversation with some people that are a whole lot smarter than I am, but they were authors of some very powerful research that literally shows so often the case is with an individual investor, even a professional fund manager, that they ride the winners way too long. They don't rebalance, and worse than that, they follow the reward. The good performers are followed up with more money, and as long as the train is still in motion, it makes for a great ride. But as soon as there's a bump in the road or the train slows down, things compound and become very bad. We might laugh at something as simple as the rule of thumb that says buy low, sell high. I mean, that's just so intuitive, it's laughable. But again, the academic research shows time and time again that as animals of habit, creatures of habit that we are, so oftentimes what we do is we are buying high and we are selling low. The person that can resist that urge, that tendency, is the person that over the long term is going to have a higher rate of return. Because we don't find ourselves buying high and selling low.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer in finance in the College of Business here at the U of I and is one of the cast who occasionally shows up here once a month on a Friday to do these programs that we do on money management. And we've been talking here in maybe a little bit in the abstract, and that's fine. But part of the reason to do these programs is for people who are listening who have specific questions about their own financial situation to call in and say, look, here's what I'm thinking about. What do you think? Do you think that what I'm talking about doing here is making sense? And you can at least get Kevin's opinion and ask particular kinds of questions. You can do that by calling us at 333-9455. That's if you're here in Champaign-Urbana. We have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also send emails to will-talk@illinois.edu. You were talking a little bit earlier about the idea that individuals' financial allocations should be shaped like the pyramid. And standard, I think, financial planning advice is that your base should be in some place that's safe. Maybe you get something on your money, but so that you can get at it. And different people maybe have different rules of thumb about just how big that base should be. Mm-hmm. And often we talk about it in terms of, you know, figuring out what your monthly expenses are and then having at least, you know, who knows, 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, 8 months to know that you could put your hands on that kind of money if you really had to. And, you know, some people are going to be comfortable with that. Some people maybe think that they would should actually be more. And maybe right now people would be saying, well, you know, I really feel that it should even be should be more than that. Is there some kind of rule of thumb, though, that says, all right, past a certain point, then to the extent that you feel comfortable, you can start thinking about doing something where the potential is greater, but also the risk is greater?
Sure. Once we get above whatever we agree upon for the safe haven funds, then when we start talking about investables and asset classes, fixed income, stocks, equities, whatever we want to call them, one of the ways I like to kind of review or start is to think about an old, again, rule of thumb, subtract your age from 100. And that's a rough approximation for an exposure to equities, to ownership of companies. So if a person were 50 years old, maybe half of their investable would be allocated to equities. And what would that mean with the other 50%? Again, this is above and beyond the kind of building block, safe money, savings accounts, CDs, so on and so forth. The other half, I advocate, again, high quality fixed income. It's not always the case. It's certainly not moment to moment. It's not month to month. 2008, 2007, to a little extent in 2009, all showed that when things go haywire, the correlations between those assets do tend to get closer to one. In other words, markets generally tend to be counter cyclical. If a person has a good investment in a stock, diversified stock fund that's doing well because the economy is doing well, generally speaking, a good investment in a good high-quality bond fund is probably not doing well. But when the economy slows, stocks do less well or poorly, the bonds kind of make up the slack. Again, generally speaking, those kinds of negative correlations happen across asset classes at extreme times, like we saw 2007, 2008, early 2009. Everything did poorly at once. I say everything, that's too strong, but most things did very poorly at once. So, again, back to the rule of thumb, subtract your age from 100 of your investables. Maybe that amount is in equities. The rest or the complement would be in high-grade, high-quality fixed income. And now, again, based on your age, the fixed income component would be adjusted to maturity. So, in other words, the older you are, the less long-term debt, the less long-term bonds you'd own, and the more near-term, short-term type of debt securities you'd own.
All right. And again, if people have been listening to the show long enough, they know when you talk about investing in stock, what you're talking about is to the extent that you can, that you want to be diversified. And so really what we're talking about here is some kind of mutual fund or funds that you can't, if you buy individual stocks, there's just no way that most investors can get appropriate kind of diversification to balance and spread out the risk and the chance that, yeah, things go up, but things also go down.
I think that's a very true statement for the vast majority of the population. My particular view for my own circumstances, for people that I've worked with throughout my career, my particular bent is individual stocks. But again, I mean, it's a little bit like saying a thoracic surgeon's approach to medicine is probably different than an attorney's approach to medicine. Now, I don't want to compare myself to someone who can heal the human body because I can't. I mean, I think that's a wonderful vocation. It's a wonderful ability, so on and so forth. But the notion that I'm trying to get across, the analogy, the purpose of the analogy is to say, my life study has been investments. I particularly enjoy analyzing companies. I enjoy choosing individual securities. And I don't think it's a garden variety activity that most people enjoy. If they don't enjoy doing those types of things, then your statement about a diversified portfolio through a mutual fund is excellent advice. Because although picking stocks is not brain surgery, it's not thoracic surgery, it is a little bit more than just kind of saying, well, this is what my broker told me.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, we're here at a midpoint here with Kevin Waspy. If you've got questions, you can call us. Particularly, people have specific questions about their investment strategies, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We have several callers here. Let's go first to Effingham, line four. Hello.
Yes. Getting off the investment, but looking at the college prepaid tuition program, the 529, you know, what's your thought of the Illinois program compared to a Bright Start or something? You know, is it going to be funded well enough that we'll pick up the college tuition of children or grandchildren now that are 9, 10 years old? Will there be funds there available for that in that 529 Illinois College program?
That's a great question, and I'll have to tell you right up front that to the best of my understanding of those programs, whoever makes the contribution under the arrangement is literally putting the money into a chosen asset, mutual fund or whatever investment selection they make. So in other words, I guess what I'm saying naively is that I don't fear an insolvency of the state of Illinois or a risk of cataclysm in some sense like we hear happening with state-funded pensions affecting those assets in a 529 plan. So in other words, it doesn't reach that level. It doesn't reach that level of risk because it's your money you're putting in. It's in an asset class or mutual fund or group of mutual funds that's separate from the obligation of the state of Illinois.
Okay, but my thought was, you know, tuition has all been going, fees have been going up 8-10% a year. You know, can their asset class sustain that to keep up with that?
I agree with what you're saying. The cost of higher education has been going up way too fast, in my opinion. Where it's going to go from this point forward, I mean, I'd like to say not as fast as it has been over the past 15 years, but there's no way I can feel comfortable with a prediction like that. The bottom line is, whatever you think it's going to be, if there's some kind of a match with a horizon, so let's say you're funding a grandchild who's currently 2 years old, if we're going to look at a 16-year investment horizon, then I think looking at asset classes like stocks, like high-quality bonds, as opposed to savings accounts, the chance of having closer to the actual cost of education in 16 years is going to be greater with those asset classes than by just putting it into a savings account.
Okay, I appreciate that thought because, you know, I was looking at, you know, at the College Illinois program, which has, you know, been promoted here quite a bit lately, and you know, for them as we see the tuition going up, as, you know, maybe this is a good long term investment for it. But, you know, I didn't know the program, but you feel the program will be safe and the state would come in if they didn't have the assets to finish it up.
Well, again, I mean, the 529 program is a part of the tax code. I mean, it basically allows people to put money into an investment product. Let's use that word as a generic, and get some tax sheltering of the growth over a period of time. Given that the commitment is the money will be used for an eligible dependent or eligible person's higher education expenses. Bottom line is, like saving for your retirement, where the money goes and what happens to it is the answer to your question. It is not a question, in my understanding of a 529 plan, whether it's state of Illinois, state of Maryland, or whoever else, okay, that it's an obligation of the state to produce a rate of return. Okay. It's basically the rate of return that is produced by the assets that you choose.
Okay. So the one I was looking at was the Illinois Student Assistance Commission one, and that's that 529. So that explains a little bit more to me.
Yeah, and again, now I have to confess ignorance here. I have a son who's going to be a sophomore at the University of Illinois. I did not put any money myself into a 529 plan. I personally saved and personally invested, hoping to make a rate of return that would provide some of money to help him pay with his educational expenses.
Right.
So bottom line is, you're talking to someone that does not know the nuances of a particular choice that you would make under the Internal Revenue Code Section 529.
Okay, I understand. Do you have I got one other question, if you got a second.
Sure.
The tax free bonds and all, somebody that's in the 30% bracket and all. If interest, let's say we invested in now, you're getting 2.5-3% return on a mix, group, 5 to 15 year bonds. If the interest rates go up, what will happen to the municipal, general interest rates go up 5 years from now? What will happen to these municipal bond funds or bonds that we presently have?
That's a great question. With interest rates as low as they are right now, people need to remember that a fixed income investment, a bond is a contract. If the interest rate that it pays annually is a fixed rate of interest, which most are, when interest rates in the environment, in the marketplace go higher, the value of those bonds go lower. Think of it as I own a piece of paper that is less advantageous than a new piece of paper that would come out today. So bottom line is, be cautious with interest rates as low as they are today. I don't think they're going to stay this low forever. That's a comfortable forecast, okay?
Right. I'll agree with you on that one.
Okay, good. So bottom line is, be prepared to see the value of those investments go down, not if, but when interest rates go higher. So I would avoid anything beyond, say, a 6 to 8 year type of maturity, whether it's a fund that buys bonds or individual bonds themselves. And I just think with a 6 to 8 year exposure, you're kind of balancing off the current yields with the risk to a rising interest rate environment, that you just don't want to stretch for yield at this point in time. You don't want to do it.
Yeah.
The longer the term to maturity, the greater the volatility of the bond price when interest rates move.
Mm-hmm.
So just don't go reaching for yield.
Yep.
Last thing I'll caution you about with municipal bonds, that's the next area that I think you're going to see big, ugly surprises in. Okay, so be very, very selective in looking at a municipal obligation.
Hmm. Okay. Appreciate that comment on it, because two things. I expect interest rates to go up here, and the municipals will look good, because I would expect tax rates are going to go up too. So if you can get any tax free, it's going to be increase your yield.
Understood. The example you gave me with a 3% yield and a 30% tax bracket, that equates to roughly a 4.25% taxable rate of return. And I can tell you right now, the 30-year Treasury bonds, which are a taxable yield, you're looking at roughly 4.25% right now. So, I understand the aspect of not paying the tax on the income. Again, I'm really cautious about municipal debt. I think it's the next crisis to occur in the coming year to 3 years.
I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. We are coming into about our last 15 minutes here with Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at the U of I. This is our monthly show on money management. We do it once a month, and it's always on Friday, and questions are welcome. We have some others, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next up is someone in Spring Bay. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, my bent is that we're in a low-growth environment. I don't see a lot of price appreciation for most stocks in the future. A person might want to consider buying dividends and rather than growth of the share price. But overall, I think that the best thing a person could do is get out of debt. If you can pay off your credit cards, you're immediately making, I don't know what the percentage is, 12% or whatever. If you can pay off your car loan, you're immediately making 8, 10%, whatever. That is known return. And if you go out and try to buy a stock or someone else's debt with a bond, you're taking a risk. So I think perhaps the most important thing for people to do, get out of debt, and I'll hang up and continue to listen to the show. Thanks.
Okay.
I think the listener makes a very good point, and perhaps we got the step or two down the road before we should have made that mention. When we talk about this pyramid and safe money and so on and so forth, the presumption I have when a person puts safe money together is that the first thing they do is look at what amount of debt they're carrying. A debt is an obligation. You know, having an outstanding credit card payment, meaning that we're doing something other than paying the full balance every month. Having an outstanding obligation on a car, even having an outstanding mortgage payment. I mean, these are the factors that go in, at least when I look at how much and where it's at, building those foundation block goes. Our listener just pointed out that there's no way that we're going to get a rate of return with anything that's close to safe, maybe not even something speculative, as high as interest rates can be on obligations that we now carry. So, excellent point. You know, when you start from the bottom, I would say the first step is let's talk about any debt. Let's make sure that we're not paying interest on debt we shouldn't want to pay interest on or be carrying, and then talk about building that safe row before we even venture into the levels above the foundation and talk about things like stocks and bonds. I mean, I'm guilty of not coming to the first step first.
All right. Well, let's go on to Champagne. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes. Is that me?
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I am one of six siblings who is going to inherit a family farm. It has about 500 acres, so it counts as a small farm. And it's a century farm. It's been in our family for over 100 years. It was in my father and mother's name, okay, for the last 30 years. My father passed away last year, and now the entire farm is in my mother's name. And she's having one of those really bad years this year with the estate tax. And I was just wondering, what is the update? What's happening with Lincoln Kyle? I'd appreciate any information that you could give us on that. We have one brother, and he has helped my parents. He's 40 now. He has helped my parents his entire life, really. He does have an 8-to-5 job in a town close by. But to, you know, keep this farm going, and all of the rest of us want him on that farm. And so the not knowing what's going on with the estate tax is just a really, really big problem. I guess I was also wondering, I heard that there might be an exemption for family farms. And again, anything you could tell me about that would be appreciated. Thank you, and I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. First of all, the big disclaimer, I'm not an attorney. I don't specialize in tax or estate work, but I'm hoping that our listener, her five siblings, their mother, have used a good estate planning attorney to handle these issues because, excuse me, they're very thorny. Now, let me add the last thorn to the crown here. What is or is not going to happen with future tax legislation is, how do I describe this? If I could predict that, predicting stock prices would be simple. So, to the best of my knowledge, the only thing we can count on right now is the Bush tax cuts expire at the end of this year. We're going to go from a very low estate tax circumstance that we live in right now into a very different environment. Regardless of which legislator has proposed what change at which hour of which debate during which house, I would not bank on that happening. I would instead plan for what is the known, and what the known is the estate taxes are going to be a real surprise, and it's not going to be a pleasant surprise beginning January 1, 2011. Bottom line is work with a good estate planning attorney. The mention about the 500 acres and six beneficiaries in an estate, I mean, this estate planner also ought to have a bit of, the human element. The worst thing I've seen in personal experiences with estate settlements are when X number of siblings get along well until. And then you can fill in the blank with after the word until. And that's where, again, some prudent planning, maybe some contractual agreements and languages, certain things like even a business aspect to it with key man life insurance, funding provisional buyouts of 1/6 owners. Those types of aspects are really, I think, ripe potential for the caller's circumstance.
Hopefully that helps. So when the tax cuts, when they phase out, are we then going back to what the estate tax was before?
Yes.
And that's still, I don't know, to me it still seems like it's a pretty high
55%.
Bar. And that you can have an estate that's what, how much before it qualifies for tax, $1 million?
It depends. And that's another avenue of the fact that this is a family farm and farming and the kinds of caveats in the tax code. We could make this the next four call-in shows.
Okay. So definitely it's a case where you need to have expert
that is the
advice.
Specialist, yes.
Yeah, all right. We have about 5 minutes here. We'll see if we can get our other caller. So we'll go over to Bloomington, Illinois for the next. This is line three. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. Since about 1994, I've been a disciple of Jeremy Siegel and his approach toward investing for retirement, and been very happy with the results up until 2007 when everything changed. And now my assets, which are primarily in stock, are worth about 1/4 of what they were in 2007. My question is: is the magnitude of the national, in your view, is the magnitude of the national debt, not the deficit, but the national debt, a game changer or a paradigm shifter? Which sort of nullifies all the conventional wisdom that I've been following, you know, as far as what you mentioned, you know, take your age and subtract your age from 100, and then that's tells you the proportion that you should be in bonds and stocks and a certain amount in cash and so on. And I guess I'm particularly thinking of the people who are recommending buying gold. And, you know, I'm aware that people like Nouriel Roubini regard gold as an antiquated relic, and others regard it as the only thing that's going to hold, you know, as a commodity, which is the only thing that may hold its value in the face of potential hyperinflation that might arise in the event that the Congress lacks the intestinal fortitude to either increase taxes to reduce the debt or to cut programs, neither of which is politically viable. And, you know, barring the possibility of our legislators becoming statesmen, how do you see the impact of the national debt on the future of someone who is, well, in my case, 60 years old?
Well, I think it's been said many times and much better than I could do in our remaining minutes on the show here, but I'd refer you to a piece in today's Wall Street Journal written by Alan Greenspan. Now, before you either vomit or begin to cheer, I'll just tell you that I don't think Alan Greenspan walks on water. I never did. But I think he's a very brilliant economist. I think, like most brilliant economists, whether it's Alan Greenspan or Nouriel Roubini or Jeremy Siegel, there are elements to what they say that you should give credence and put through your own "does that make sense" sieve. So in today's Wall Street Journal on the op-ed page, Greenspan's got this piece that basically answers your question. Yes, the level of current debt in this country is at a game-changing tipping point. And I think I'm going to pick an argument with you, because during your discussion, you said something about either raising taxes or cutting programs is politically impractical.
Mm-hmm.
The point I think he's trying to make in this piece in today's paper is the point I've been trying to make for quite some time, and he's a heck of a lot more famous than I am, so credit his publicist and not mine. The point is this: we are getting to the point where the markets will choose that decision for us. If we don't want somebody else to make that choice for us, it's time to find a spine and start making some of the tough decisions now. So to say something is politically impossible, or to say that it's politically improbable even, tells me that the political system is not serving the need, which, in my opinion, it's done a poor job serving many needs. But that's, again, the next three call-in shows.
Is that at all getting at your question?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of at a loss because I haven't read Greenspan's article today, but I guess I would just close by saying that I just find it hard to imagine politicians either proposing to raise taxes, just imagine in Illinois, or to cut social programs.
Well, any program, social or otherwise. Bottom line is,
how is this going to happen?
How's it going to happen? I think we're going to find a different breed of elected representative eventually. That's my hope.
I hope so.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. We'll see if we can get real quick one more in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Yes, I have a quick question. And could you tell me, please, about I-bonds and what is the maximum one can put in during the year?
On that, I would have to say we really don't have the time to go into it. If you could call me off the program, maybe we could talk a little bit about I-bonds.
Okay, I have invested in some other years, but I know that there's a maximum, and I just wondered if you knew what that is.
Off the top of my head, this year, no, I do not.
Yeah, I'm sure if you would call your bank, they would be able to tell you.
That's a good idea, and thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, we're kind of at the point where you have to finish up here. Any sort of last thought for this go-round on this topic you'd like to leave with folks?
No, I think, again, I'd like to thank you for being here. I know it's always fun to talk with the callers. It's hopefully something that the listeners find value from, and I think, you know, WILL does a nice job reaching out to the public and hoping to provide a valuable benefit to them.
I thank you very much. And next, probably Dave will be here next time around, or somebody will be here.
I think you're stuck with me.
Kevin Wasby will be back here again in the month of July. Hey, we're happy to have you. In July, look for him again. It'll be a Friday, and we'll take your questions on money management. And we will hear pretty quick, see if we can get the couch potato portfolio updated on our website. So if you're interested in seeing one kind of approach to how you would diversify your investments, it lays out a number of different mutual funds and shows how they've been doing. So probably early next week we'll get that updated for you.
Sounds good. Thank you, David.
Well, we're just about midpoint here of this morning's focus. And in the next part of the program, we'll be doing something a little bit different, certainly talking about a different topic. We'll be talking about one of the best known, most recognized compositions in all of the Western tradition of Western classical music, and that is Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. It was first performed in 1824. We'll talk a little bit about the work, about the composer, what was going on in the world in 1824 when it premiered, and our guest for the show will be Harvey Sachs. So that's coming up in the next Hour of Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, where visitors of all ages can uncover and discover the wonderment of America's musical past through guided tours Monday through Friday at the University of Illinois. More information is at sousaarchives.org. Support for today's broadcast comes from Rodney G. Peacock presenting Noontide Festival Month, June 18th through July 11th at Vollinger Auditorium, with music, poetry, and drama highlighted by a concert by Rodney George Peacock and with his original drama, The Noontide Trilogy, July 2nd through the 11th. Information under events at vollinger.illinois.edu.
And right now we'll break, as we usually do, for an update on the markets and news.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey at mid-session. At the Chicago Board of Trade and in Kansas City, grains are staging an end-of-the-week rally. In Chicago, July wheat is up following the rally that we're also seeing over in Kansas City, as well as the Minnesota grain trade, as top-quality wheat is becoming a harder item to come by due to the excessive wet weather in the Canadian prairies that is trimming wheat production prospects there. Meanwhile, the corn has also been helped by weather ideas as premium is being added into the marketplace. And on a technical basis, corn is actually moving above its 50.